sister ship will follow suit.
Today I can announce that the second carrier, HMS Prince of Wales, will also be brought into service. This will ensure that we always have one carrier available 100% of the time.
The Pentagon says a co-founder of the Al-Shabaab Islamist group has been killed in a US airstrike in Somalia. Ahmed Ghodan was one of America's most wanted men with a £4 million bounty on his head. A private memorial service is getting underway shortly for one of the American journalists beheaded by Islamic State militants. The ceremony for Stephen Sotloff will take place at a synagogue in Miami. Former N-Dub singer Dappy has been found guilty of assaulting a man at a nightclub in Reading. The 27-year-old was convicted of punching a man on the dance floor. Magistrates have warned him he could face jail. And England's cricketers have secured a morale-boosting win over India in the fifth and final one-day international of their series at Headingley. It means a five-game contest BCFM. Finishes 3-1. That's the latest.
I'm Roman Widger. Join me for my show on BCFM every Wednesday, where I play everything from pop classics right up to the modern day, including soul, band, folk, and even classical, with a range of special features highlighting Bristol's rich tapestry, interviews with fascinating people, and a range of fun and serious articles. The Roman Widger Show, Wednesday, 10 till noon, every week.
Yeah, this is Levi Roots, Dragon Slayer, and you're listening to the One Love Breakfast. Respect you.
Wake up to the One Love Breakfast every weekday morning from 7 a.m. on Ujima 98 and BCFM 93.2. Keeping Bristol together. Come and join the thousands of people who care about our city and the diverse communities that make it up. Wake up to the One Love Breakfast, Bristol's only local breakfast show that celebrates diversity. The One Love Breakfast, every weekday from 7 on Ujima 98 and BCFM 93.2. You've been so good to me. Give you
anything. Tune in to Real Women every Tuesday, 12 till 1. Lively chat, the best music, and topics from a women's perspective.
Everyone's welcome. Real Women, Tuesday, 12 till 1. BCFM 93.2.
Okay, Greek sounds coming on. Away from Luigiano. Gotta do these names when I'm fully awake. We in a party. Okay, gotta say good morning. That's why I always say to people.
The Desi Ranking Show on BCFM.
Tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12.
Oh, poor Desi. He goes between 10 and 12 every Sunday. And my God, does he like it turned up to 11 when he's in the studio. Do tune in. It's great fun. Mentioning more tuning ins here at BCFM, the Saturday edition. Tomorrow kicks off the autumn arts season. Charlotte Fitzjohn, Kevin Restall and myself are here from 10. And we're going to be talking theatre, poetry, filmmaking, amazingness, classical music composition and Wilder Street drug dealers. It's going to be a full show, after which you can hear Nostalgia Ain't What It Used To Be with Martin Spilacy, and Finn and the team are doing Finn's final youth show tomorrow from 1 p.m. Martin Saunders. Summers, I beg your pardon. Martin Saunders, somebody entirely different. Yeah. Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is still here with me in the Friday Politics studio. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in this week for Tony Gosling, who is on his hollyhulls. We both hope and wish him a lovely time, do we not?
Indeed.
And you've got a whisper of a world premiere we can look forward to.
Yes, I've been approached by somebody this week to break a story which is probably going to be in the mainstream media next week, but we've been allowed to run with it first. And I can't give the source of the story, but I've got some names here. I'll be very brief. Dr. Stephen Davis is the former Canon Emeritus of Coventry Cathedral, and he's worked in Nigeria for a number of years. He's a Niger Delta negotiator for the Archbishop of Canterbury. So what he does is he goes there and deals with hostage situations and so on. But anyway, by and large, he doesn't like to be have the finger pointed at him, because he's a bit like Terry Waite in the past. He doesn't really want everybody to know what he's up to, because he's actually the Archbishop of Canterbury's personal representative in these very sensitive situations. But anyway, I understand that next week he's going to accuse local politicians in the north of Nigeria of channeling money to Boko Haram group that kidnapped the girls, or at least that we're told have kidnapped these girls and so on.
Channeling more money, should we say, because there's rumours that Al-Qaeda money is being channeled heavily.
This Al-Qaeda money, there's a guy called Abu Qudus who's been arrested by the government in Egypt. Of course, we could argue about whether that's a legitimate government and whether they should be allowed to arrest people at all, but he's been arrested. But the money has been channeled through the Central Bank of Nigeria, and there are three particular names of politicians which Stephen Davis is suggesting should be arrested as basically funding terrorism in Nigeria, and that's Ali Medu Sherif, who's the former Borno state governor. I've never heard of him. Lamido Sanusi, who is a central bank governor who's been suspended by the president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, for financial irregularities. But the suggestion from Davis is that it's not just financial irregularities, that it's because of this funding for Boko Haram. And the third person being mentioned is Babangida, who was the former military dictator of Nigeria. And another politician is Atiku Abu Bakar. Now, I don't suppose our audience in Bristol will know Mary. I've heard of Babangida before, I hadn't heard of any of the others. But I understand that this is going to be in the mainstream media next week. Mm-hmm. And my source gave it to this programme because they wanted it to be, they wanted it to start as a grassroots exposure.
Okay, this leads us on to an interesting strand of conversation, because is it not a politician's right to support certain causes?
It is, but I mean, Boko Haram, as we know, are engaged in the Nigerian army, of course, have got a fairly spotty reputation for human rights abuse and so on. So it's not a black and white situation. These situations never are. But on the other hand, what seems to be happening is that these politicians, who are political opponents of Goodluck Jonathan, are channeling funds to Boko Haram to create chaos, and then accusing Jonathan of not doing enough to stop the chaos. So, in other words, what we're dealing with here is the political use of Islamic terrorism in order to achieve certain directed political goals.
So when we're talking funds, are we talking about Nigerian state funds? Are we talking international aid money?
This is international funds from what has been spoken to me as Al-Qaeda. Now, what is Al-Qaeda? We've been using this word for many, many years. But I mean, I think what we're talking about here is, we know that the rebels in Syria, for example, have been getting large amounts of money from the Gulf states, from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, from the United Arab Emirates, and also help from Turkey, which is actually part of NATO. I think we're talking about those kind of financial resources.
Mm-hmm.
To my mind, as you know, somebody observes these things, there is no straightforward thing where you could say, well, Al-Qaeda, aren't they the bad guys? I mean, in Syria, the rebels in Syria, the Al-Nusra Front, the new ISIS Front and all the rest of it, they have been funded by these similar groups for many, many years, for the last 2 or 3 years, for sure.
And about 2 years ago, William Hague was talking about making sure that they were supported by British government and guns.
Well, indeed, and of course, there is also evidence that, for example, there's stuff on the internet about how John McCain was inside Syria in Erbil last year, in a rebel-controlled area, meeting with this chap, al-Baghdadi, who is now the caliph of the ISIS state, supposedly. So there's actually photographic evidence of a senior US politician meeting with this chap, who has now become public enemy number one. I mean, this is one of the issues which is being discussed up in Newport, of course.
Is there not a case with your source on this? And I don't dispute your source may have legitimate grounds to bring this to your attention. You say the chap who's doing this expose is an emissary of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
And he is talking about naming and shaming potential jihadis,
uh-huh,
who are fighting what, in jihadi terms, they see as a holy war of Islam versus Christianity.
I think the main point here is that mainstream politicians, who are the mainstream political opponents of the current Nigerian government are implicated in this.
But are presumably some of these politicians, by the sound of their names, will be Muslim.
Indeed they might. Now, I'm not even sure. This is information I've been given, and I put it in front of the listeners. This is what I've been told, and maybe next week you'll hear more about it if you're watching the mainstream media. I have my suspicions because of what we've been saying about Syria. It's quite clear that there is massive linkages between Islamic terrorist groups of various kinds, including Boko Haram. Probably the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, have had an intimate relationship with MI6 going back decades. So, for example, when Annie Mashon and David Shaler left MI5 in the 1990s. Why they left was because there was an assassination attempt on Gaddafi being run through the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was basically the Libyan chapter of Al-Qaeda, if you want to call it that. And I
think we should probably call it proto-Al-Qaeda.
Yes, but the point is that and everybody knows Operation Cyclone, which shipped jihadis into Afghanistan in the 1980s to fight the Soviets, that was run... The lead agency on Operation Cyclone was MI6. It was subcontracted by the Americans to the British because they were regarded as the experts on Islamism.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the relationship between intelligence services, Western British intelligence services, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt goes back to the Nasser era because they were the opposition to Nasser and so on. So, but we're asked to believe that this very intimate relationship with jihadi groups that goes back decades has suddenly gone sour, and they've decided that they are going to attack us. I mean, we've got British special forces personnel, probably both in Turkey and in Jordan, training people mm-hmm. to fight inside Syria, and now suddenly we're all running around like headless chickens because they're the worst thing that's ever happened to Syria, and so on and so forth.
Afternoon, of course, David Cameron has turned around at the NATO conference and pledged 25%. 1,000 special forces, UK British Army special forces, to this new NATO 48-hour 4,000-strong strike force.
Well, that's more directed against the Russians, I understand.
Indeed it is directed at the Russians, but, you know, you've got a NATO strike force. All of these Islamic states, or states with Islam as the state religion, as Iran does, or indeed majority Islam populations, like most of the Middle East mm-hmm. does, and what's to say that NATO isn't going to start sending their 4,000...
Well, it is a bit bizarre.
To Libya, for instance.
Well, it is a bit... Well, NATO bombed Libya, as we know, a couple of years ago. It was the RAF. That actually began... There was something called Operation Southern Mistral 2011.
Yes, thanks for that one, William Hague. £6 million a day it cost the UK taxpayer.
Well, what's very interesting about that is that Southern Mistral 2011 was a war game between the French and British air forces, which would involve a unnamed country, which was going to be in the south of France, which was a Muslim country, which had an uprising, and then the leader of that Muslim country would then use air power against the protesters. There would be a UN resolution, and then they would move in. So this whole war game, which was to kick off on, I think it was March the 10th or something, suddenly, by March the 11th, it's actually for real. Now, in other words, there was a planned takedown. If the implication of that is that there was a planned takedown of Gaddafi.
Oh, yes, of course.
It wasn't just responding to events. And I think with the Arab Spring now behind us, we can see that an awful lot of what was going on was being manipulated by outside forces. They were encouraged. It's like in Switzerland, they have people who go around and make avalanches happen. They're going to happen anyway. Avalanches always happen. But somebody flies around in a helicopter and makes the avalanches happen so that the skiers will be safe. And it seems to me that the Arab Spring was going to happen anyway. But because it was going to happen anyway, people decided they were going to steer it in various directions. And that's
surely, Martin Summers, you're not suggesting there's an unseen Western hand, possibly on a government salary, at work.
I'm afraid I am, because Operation Cyclone, there's a very good film, which is a Hollywood film with Tom Cruise as the lead.
Oh, then it must be lead. True.
Oh, it's called... Charlie Wilson's War. Charlie Wilson was a Texas senator. He was a good old boy, a whiskey drinking, cocaine snorting, prostitute visiting boy, and he decided in the 1980s that he was going to give covert support to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And this film was made not that long ago, and it's a heroic film about what a heroic guy he is. He's a lovable rogue. He's a lovable rogue, and he just gets all of these kind of ground-to-air missiles to these Islamic extremists, and they trash the Russians, and at the end of the film, it's all a great, wow, fantastic, what a great job we've done. Now, in other words, there's no doubt about the fact that people boasted it was the biggest undercover operation in history, Operation Cyclone, and the US openly boast of their success in achieving what they achieved. And then suddenly, the Islamist terrorists, which we've armed, trained, I mean, apparently I understand SAS were training Islamist terrorists in how to shoot down aircraft in Scotland. But we've got, as I say, the relationship is intimate. Now, at
really?
What point
they were training terrorists to shoot down passenger aircraft in Scotland, and it wasn't Abdel Bassett al-Megrahi?
No. Well, that's another question, of course, because Megrahi probably... you know why they had to release Megrahi? It was the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish government said it's because he was dying and so on. Mm-hmm. In actual fact, it was just about to come to appeal. And when it came to appeal, a Scottish police inspector was going to testify that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene, to wit, planting one circuit board on the crime scene, which implicated Libya. Now, in actual fact, if you think about it, a bomb with a circuit board in it doesn't leave a circuit board at the end of it. When the bomb goes off, there ain't no circuit board. So this circuit board is clearly a misdirection.
Brilliant.
But I mean, you'll understand, if you get an independent Scotland, we might be sending Taggart and other Scottish police officers over to Scotland, over to Langley, Virginia, to say, now, you've been interfering with our crime scene. Now, the implication, of course, if Libya didn't do it, somebody else did, and they're still out there.
Well, indeed. Okay, we're going to take some music before we do that, because this is music that harks back to the halcyon days of African liberation from colonialism. We're going to hear Fela Kuti, and it ties in with a movie that's showing at the Watershed this coming week as part of the Africa Eye Film Festival. But please remind us what we should be looking out for in the media in the week ahead regarding the channeling of Al-Qaeda funds through state-elected and appointed individuals in northern Nigeria, putting essentially guns and bullets in the hands of jihadis.
Well, it's going to come from Dr. Stephen Davis, who actually works for the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the people they're accusing are the former Borno State Governor, Ali Modu Sharif, the Central Bank Governor, who's now been suspended, Lamido Sanusi, Babangida, who's the former dictator of Nigeria, and another guy called Atiku Abubakar, who's another sponsor of this. Now, this is what I've been told. It may be wrong, but keep your eyes out and keep your ears open, and you'll see more about it next week in the mainstream media.
You mentioned that these people should be arrested. Who should they be arrested by? Well, surely if they're arrested by their domestic police forces, they will be accused of being political
prisoners.
Well,
that's prisoners. This is the sensitivity of this story. But I think the idea that Boko Haram are being channeled money from Al-Qaeda, it's hardly surprising. You'd expect that. The question is, are mainstream politicians who ought to be defending the state undermining the state? And I think this is exactly what Dr. Stephen Davis is going to accuse them of. And he's not somebody that would normally come out of the shadows to do this. He's making, you know, normally he just keeps quiet and works behind the scenes. But I understand that next week he's not going to.
It's murky, frankly, because
these things usually are.
What are you going to do? Are you going to set these people up as war criminals in The Hague? And also, may I say, with what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Syria and northern Iraq and everything else, and NATO and Scotland, there are still 160 formerly Christian schoolgirls that are being retained at Boko Haram's leisure.
Yes, well, I mean, the question is, what is Boko Haram? Well, it may well be that terrorist groups, like I was handing out a leaflet at NATO last week about Gladio. What often happens is that terrorism is usually being supported by some intelligence agency or another. It doesn't just happen on its own. Mm. And it's used to undermine governments that people don't like, to try and get access to resources and so on. So the kind of moral, oh, isn't it terrible that these girls have been kidnapped and so on, I think that's part of the whole, it's a psychological warfare game that's being played with ordinary people being mashed up as pawns in that game.
And is it terrible because they're Christian and were forced to convert to Islam, or is it terrible kidnapping children is a bad thing?
Well, kidnapping children is a bad thing, and people shouldn't be doing it. But I think what's going on, I mean, look at ISIS, for example. Al-Baghdadi was meeting with Western representatives quite recently, and it's being openly said in the Islamic world that ISIS is a front for Mossad CIA. That's being openly said.
Brilliant. We'll have to come back to that. We did mention Nigeria, and I did mention that you can engage with the Nigerian story. It's actually tonight at the Watershed Cinema. Get down there for about 7:30. The show starts at 7:50. It's called Finding Fela. For those of you unfamiliar with Fela, he was the architect of the Afrobeat movement, along with Ebo Taylor, who developed really the signature sound of highlife in Ghana. They were both at college in London together in the late 50s and early 1960s. I'm going to tell you a little more about him from the press release that was sent to me by Simon Bright at the Africa Eye Film Festival. The story of Afrobeat pioneer get the words out, Bill. You see what you've done to me, Martin Summers? The story of Afrobeat pioneer, multi-instrumentalist, human rights activist and all-round rhythmic genius Fela Kuti is brought to captivating life by Oscar award-winning documentary maker Alex Gibney. You'll like this because he also made the documentary about Enron, the smartest guys in the room. And I know Enron is one of your favourite stories.
I like Fela Kuti as well.
Kuti rose to fame in the 1970s by creating Afrobeat, which fused jazz, funk, highlife, psychedelic rock and traditional West African chants. And it became the backdrop to Africa's post-colonial activism and the quest for freedom, which is what has precipitated a number of these strong men. Indeed, Robert Mugabe is being a prime example, retaining power in Africa for an awfully long time. And it was set to the backdrop of the music of Fela Kuti and others. We're going to hear some more from Fela Kuti, some of his tunes in a minute, but this is being followed up by Afrobeat Party, courtesy of Rise Records, in the cafe bar from 10 o'clock onwards. Let's have a little bit of Fela at his best. This is a track called Zombie.
zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, no go go unless you tell him to go.
Zombie,
zombie, no go stop unless you tell him to stop.
Zombie,
zombie, no go turn unless you tell him to turn.
Zombie,
zombie, no go think unless you tell him to think.
Zombie,
zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie,
zombie, no go go unless you tell him to go.
Zombie,
zombie, no go stop unless you tell him to stop.
Zombie,
zombie, no go turn unless you tell him to turn.
Zombie,
zombie, no go think.
And he fades off into the distance. That is an excerpt from Fela Kuti's Zombie. I warn you, if you're a Fela fan, then you will be aware a lot of his tracks are long. They're amazing, but long. So that was the shortest, punchiest one I could find at just over 6 minutes. Do get down to the Watershed this evening. The film starts at 10 minutes to 8. It's called Finding Fela, and that is the curtain raiser to an Afrobeat party, courtesy of Rise Records, which kicks off at 10 after the screening. It's going to cost you £8 for a full price ticket, or £6.50 on a concessionary rate. And Martin Summers, I play that especially because I'm not certain that Fela and an awful lot of his contemporaries who are using music as a politically activizing tool had aspirations that Nigeria would start kidnapping, or Nigerians would start kidnapping fellow Nigerian schoolgirls and holding them to ransom.
Well, no, obviously not. I mean, there was an era of hope and enthusiasm for independence in many of these African countries, and not always fulfilled. And Nigeria, we had the Biafran Civil War years ago, and there's still potentially all sorts of violent possibilities in the situation, although I'm quite sure that most Nigerians are peace-loving, decent people, like most people everywhere.
Why is this still occurring? I appreciate that Nigeria is a young country. It's less than 50 years old, but they've got oil, they've got plenty of dosh. Is that the problem?
Well, don't forget that all of these countries were created by the colonialists to suit their purposes. And I think there's 120 different ethnic groups in Nigeria. It's a huge place.
Mm.
It's so big, and there's such a patchwork that, you know, having a federal big federal state seemed like a better solution than having people breaking away. I mean, the Organization of African Unity have still got a basic rule, which is that despite the borders of the countries concerned being completely artificial, that we're not going to start changing borders in Africa, because that will open Pandora's box to everybody demanding independence, like Yugoslavia on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not actually been stuck to strictly. Eritrea has found independence now from Ethiopia, and South Sudan has split from North Sudan, not entirely happily. And there's a real danger that a country like Nigeria with 120 different ethnic groups could become a bit of a mess unless there is common sense and compromise.
Interesting. Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of topics I would like to talk about, but I would like to frame the next part of our discussion in the context of, first of all, to mention, I think, this is merely my opinion, the delicacy and the reverence and the tact with which the outbreak of the First World War has been approached in Britain and in France and indeed around the world. It was a genuinely terrible episode in human history.
It was, and I think in Germany, of course, they are still remembering it, as we are, but they're remembering it in a slightly different way. The Germans are saying, well, let's not make these mistakes again. There's a bit of a tendency in Britain and the US to regard these things as our, you know, our World Cup victories, if you like, and to pat ourselves on the back.
Mm.
And in actual fact, of course, the real message of all of this, and the real message of Remembrance Sunday, of course, is not to do it again.
Exactly.
Not to go on about how wonderful it was, but how terrible it was.
Well, unfortunately, this tees us up rather nicely for what appears to be happening. Because if we roll the clock back 100 years and about 4 months, a Serbian separatist, Gavrilo Princip, decided to put a bullet in the Austro-Hungarian equivalent of Prince William. Mm. He was the heir to the empire. He was going to be the next emperor. And a youngish man. His father had been presiding over matters for over 60 years. Funnily enough, rather similar to our current the current incumbent of the British throne, put a bullet in his head and his wife, and 4 years later, there's 28 million people dead.
Well, so, and of course, when it first happened, the world was a much bigger place than it is now. Most people in Europe thought, well, this has nothing to do with us. And in one way, it wasn't. Austria decided to use it as an excuse to... that they blame the Serbian government for Princip's action. Now, a bit like Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda today, there is suspicions that he did, in fact, have contacts with the Serbian intelligence service, although... they weren't direct. Plausible deniability. But nevertheless, the Austrians decided that this was going to be an excuse, from their point of view, to punish Serbia. Now, that wouldn't necessarily have been a problem. Austria and Serbia go to war over Bosnia. Everybody else can just sit and watch and perhaps stand on the sidelines and say, well, do we need a ceasefire? I understand there's been a ceasefire called and implemented this afternoon in Ukraine, which I welcome.
Well, we're building up to that.
We'll come to that. But in any case, you could imagine that playing out like that, yeah? So Serbia and Austria have a fight, but everybody else just... But what happened was the Russian government, not because of its autocratic tendencies, but because of its less autocratic tendencies, but popular pressure was to support the Orthodox Serbs against the Austrians. And the Austrian ultimatum to the Serbs was one designed to make them fight. It was, you know, there was nothing in it that they could compromise about.
No, but ironically, the Serbs agreed to each one of the conditions laid out in the Austrian ultimatum.
Yeah. And but the Austrians weren't interested in that, and they decided that they wanted to go to war. Then the Russians started to mobilise in order to protect the Serbs.
This is where it starts to echo quite closely what's going on today, because there was a little bit of Muscovite sabre-rattling going on in the background all the time.
Yes, and don't forget that Britain fought on the side of Russia. So we are implicated in that Muscovite sabre-rattling in 1914. That's how the Germans would see it. And don't forget that the Russian army did, in fact, invade Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They did. And they got their backsides kicked, as you might imagine. But nevertheless, they did do that. And the working class movement in Germany, the Social Democrats and so on, were persuaded to support the Kaiser's government on the grounds that we don't want the Russians coming in here and smashing our trade unions, blah, blah, blah. That's how the Germans saw it. And I think I read a lot of history books, Billy, and what you find is how similar people are to us. You know, people are always the same in different circumstances, and also how different people are. And, you know, I don't think it makes much sense to look back on things in history and take viciously strong sides. Most people throughout most of history thought that they were doing the right thing by their own lights.
Martin,
they did.
Believe me, you're preaching to the converted. I'm Irish. I grew up with this. There is undeniable echoes of what happened 100 years ago, almost to the day, to what's happening in South Wales right now.
There is. And as I say, if there has been a ceasefire this afternoon, I'm extremely pleased to hear it, because that's what should have been happening from the get-go.
José Manuel Barroso, the EU Commissioner, arrived at Bristol Airport yesterday on his way to the conference, the NATO conference, I might add, as well as the current incumbent of the presidency of Ukraine, who aren't NATO members.
No, he's there as a guest, I suppose.
And Barroso's quote from the airport was, "Europe will not go to war with Russia over Ukraine." Does that sound like Britain will not go to war over Serbia?
Well, I hope not, because I think the difference in this case is that Russia has changed from 1914. Putin, whatever people may think about him, is an elected leader, and there is a policy making elite in Russia, if you like, which has actually got some common sense. They're not being driven by ideology. They're rather realistic and pragmatic, and they've been... I mean, if you think about it, from the Russian General Staff's point of view, when Donetsk and Luhansk voted in a rather hurried fashion to secede from Ukraine. No more hurried than, of course, Slovenia voted in 1991 to leave Yugoslavia, or Ireland voted to leave the British Empire in 1988.
Well, frankly, we had been militating for that for 700 years.
Well, yes, indeed. But at the same time, the actual vote itself was a bit of a rushed thing. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's quite clear. I mean, anybody watching that would say, well, it's pretty clear that these people do not want to be part of... Don't forget that the government in Kiev came to power through a military coup. originally in February. So the shootings in the Maidan, I'll just quickly run people up. People who listen to the show regularly will be aware of this. But the shootings in the Maidan Square.
Maidan Square is kind of towards the end of the story. Let's go back to the Orange Revolution first.
Yeah.
Okay, so take it from there.
So the Orange Revolution, there's a group called Canvas based in Belgrade, which used to be called Otpor Resistance. Canvas stands for Centre for Active Nonviolence, something or other. Now, they're actually funded by the US National Endowment for Democracy. They are what I call the CIA's 1968 department.
Mm-hmm.
So what tends to happen is with the CIA and imperialist powers and so on, they fight people like the Cubans, and then they suddenly discover guerrilla warfare, which then leads on to so they invent their own version of it.
Let me finish that saying. It leads on to the Mujahideen and the contra-rebels in Nicaragua.
Yes, it does. But what tends to, and of course, the these mass movements of largely young people demanding change, they've taken that on board. And of course, people do demand change, whether it's in Syria or Russia or anywhere else. I mean, there's obviously going to be discontent in any society. But there's a whole series of techniques which have been developed for running revolutions. So you have various revolutions, colour revolutions, as they call them, Orange Revolution, the Tulip Revolution, the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon. So in other words, this is a pattern. And it's basically, that's not to say there are not genuine grievances in the society's concern, because there certainly are. But there's also an attempt to manipulate these. I mean, for example, Newland has admitted that the US government spent $5 billion in Ukraine on encouraging people to protest against the government and so on. So in other words, people like myself who are against the British government would get their own radio station as part of that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, bring
Great
it
stuff.
On. No, don't bring it on.
But you see what I'm saying? Yeah, you
no,
see what
I,
I'm driving
I,
at
I know
there?
Exactly what you're driving
You know,
at,
so
yes.
I mean, it would be great if Putin was to pay me to have my own radio station, but he's not going to.
So
but, I mean, that's the kind of thing. That's, and Berezovsky was very important in the Orange Revolution.
Indeed, who ended up getting poisoned.
Well, no, that's your thing of Litvinenko.
Oh, yes, a bigger
Berezovsky was the... He was like the Rupert Murdoch of Russia.
Okay.
So it was him and Gusinski who controlled all of the TV and radio.
Was Berezovsky the guy they found dead in Surrey recently?
That's the one who the coroner said that he couldn't accept that it was basically said it was foul play.
Yeah.
Now, Berezovsky is a very interesting character because what happened in 1999... November 1999. This book came out in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
This is my book.
get the plug in. We will hear a quote.
It's not even available. But in 1999, after this book came out, and I used to work in Eastern Europe, as you know, Billy. The situation in Russia was such that the ordinary people had basically had a massive drop in their living standards. Huge. The shock therapy had been pushed through. It was Thatcherism on steroids for them. And the ordinary people had lost out massively. A small group of oligarchs around Chubais, who was the finance minister, had basically taken over all of the major industries. And there was going to be a general election for the presidency, and Gennady Zyuganov, who was the head of the Communist Party, was definitely looking as if he was going to win. Now, this would have been, to my mind, quite an interesting development. Because if you had a democratically elected communist government in Russia that was going to approach marketization in a more moderate way, mm-hmm. rather than in a shock, that might have been very good for Russia and good for the world. But it didn't happen because all these bombs went off in Moscow and
Ryazan. Yes, I remember them, yeah.
Killing hundreds, mostly in working class apartment blocks.
And for then, a change, yes.
Yeah, well, this is the point. This is how this stuff works. And this was because Berezovsky and various other parts of the oligarchy just could not tolerate a communist victory. They thought that the communists were going to renationalise the industries that they'd filched.
Now, it's important that we present a little bit of balance here. Gorbachev said, do you know what, Reagan? You're right. You've had it right all along. Democracy is the future.
Yep.
And then Yeltsin ended up... Yeltsin, who was quite an old man at the time, mm-hmm. so he was dyed-in-the-wool communist anyway, ended up as the first democratically elected president in Russia after Perestroika.
Yeah. I remember I was in what was then still Leningrad the day he was elected.
And it was a great day for the world. It was the end of the Cold War.
Well, it was and it wasn't, because then what Yeltsin then went on to do, he got his advisor Gaidar, who was actually a former Red Army general's son, and Gaidar had been got at by the IMF and the City of London and so on, and they went for shock therapy. Now, that actually was a silly policy, in my view. This is what my book, Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle, which I wrote with Laszlo Andor, who's currently a European Commissioner for Jobs and Growth in Brussels. So we wrote that book together at the end of the 90s, critiquing everything that had happened. Shock therapy was not the right policy in these circumstances. You should have taken steady steps towards a market economy without trying to jump in one go and all the rest of it.
Obviously you need to phase any regime change in or any mode of thinking.
What then happened, of course, is that the parliament in Russia, the Duma, started to resist the policies that were coming from the presidential office. And then, of course, if you remember, Yeltsin stormed the parliament. The military stormed the parliament and prorogued the parliament.
Indeed.
Which Poroshenko has now done in Ukraine, by the way.
Yes.
He's got rid of the parliament.
Well, this brings us back to what we were talking about. So fast forward about 11 years to the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Yep. Because after Perestroika, the Soviet Union, as we know it, becomes a federation of former Soviet states. And we have a whole bunch of problems in Yugoslavia. You have the Baltic states acceding power and becoming member states of the European Union. You've got former communist countries like Albania really just finding themselves completely in the doldrums and at a loss. And these are the former buffer zones between what was the West and what the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s, Billy. And, of course, I would say that the shock therapy approach, which Yugoslavia was the most marketized of all of the East European countries.
And also...
And the most integrated of the West, and the most in debt.
And it had a benevolent figurehead that the general population could still stand behind as a war hero who had fought
Hitler. Well, I mean, you know, there are arguments to be said for and against that. But the point is, it was, in fact, the most integrated into the Western system. And what they did, as the Poles and the Hungarians had done, is in the 1970s they borrowed quite a lot of money from Western bankers in order to improve the living standards of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the downside of that is you then got to pay them back.
Yes,
and the you know, as people in Africa, in Nigeria, will tell you, paying this money back can be an absolute pain.
Or indeed Haiti, for that matter.
Indeed.
No, listen, we need to get to the Orange Revolution to put flesh on the bones of why Ukraine is the tinderbox it is now.
Okay, well, let me just read. This is quite a short piece from my book. I wrote this in 1998. I wrote this paragraph, but Laszlo Andor also agreed that this is a joint effort. Okay? A thorough structural adjustment of the Ukraine, probably leading to mass unemployment of Russian speakers in the eastern industrial districts of the country, is current IMF policy. This is in 1998. Up to now, the government in Kiev has wisely found all sorts of reasons why such a policy cannot be implemented. How long they can hold out against the enormous pressure exerted on them by Western creditors in the middle of a permanent economic crisis is anybody's guess. Non-payment of wages is already a significant source of grievance. The temptation for the Russian-speaking population in the Donbass and the Crimea to avoid structural adjustment implemented by Kiev through irredentist mobilisation will be high. It is possible that only when parts of the European heartland, such as Ukraine, have been completely destabilised by the free market dogma, that there will be any fundamental rethink of Western policy. By then, it will be far too late.
Okay.
In other words, even in 1998, it was obvious that a structural adjustment Thatcherite policy, which would be pushed from Kiev, the west of the country, on the east of the country is enormous South Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
For them, it's a silly policy. And of course, don't forget the country Ukraine only existed since 1991. And Crimea has only been in the Ukraine since 1954, when Khrushchev, who was drunk and came from the Ukraine, decided to put it into the Ukraine. Because that's the sort of thing that could happen in those days.
Fast forward to where we are now. We had an Orange Revolution and the poor president...
The Orange Revolution led to a change of government to a pro-Western government.
Well, there was...
The Yevtushenko government.
Yulia Tymoshenko ended up there, and then she was outed by the guy who was poisoned with the pockmarked face.
Yes, yes. I mean, what you've got... What happened in Ukraine... In Russia, they had the shock therapy, the Yeltsin era, and then Putin was the response of what they call the Siloviki, the security structure, to the takeover by the oligarchy. So the bombings in Moscow and Ryazan, which we were talking about earlier, in my view, they were carried out by the oligarchy using Putin as their as their means. Yeah, so Putin was hardly... nobody knew who Putin was. Berezovsky found Putin and said, look, this is our guy. He will sort this out for us.
Okay.
And so the bombs went off. It was blamed on the Chechens. The Chechens invaded Dagestan, which they had no reason to do, but Berezovsky had influence with Samuel Bashev, and he made him do that. So then, of course, the population is absolutely terrorised, traumatised. The communists were going to win the election, but Putin rides in on a white horse and said, no, I will deal with this, and so he did. They invaded Chechnya again, and the Chechen war restarted. But Zyuganov didn't. What Zyuganov said in the 1999 election, he said, it's now a straight fight between the Communist Party, me, and the former KGB, Putin. But of course, Putin won. But then Putin double crossed the oligarchy. He basically said, look, you know, I've sorted this out for you. Now you are going to behave within the Russian national interests. So Korzakovsky, for example, many of the oligarchs have dual Israeli Russian citizenship. They just do. And Korzakovsky was about to set up an oil deal with the Israelis, which was basically against the Russian national interests. And Putin then suddenly discovered he hadn't paid his taxes and sent him to Siberia. The way the Siloviki work in Russia, which is the security structure, is they allow the oligarchs to make money, whatever, as long as they behave themselves. But of course, they've got phone transcripts, everything, of how they got their money. And if anybody steps out of line, then they can immediately be accused of fraud, what have you.
Well,
because they're all fraudsters. So it's quite easy. It's easy enough to send them down if that's what you want to do.
Thank God for the surveillance state, they say. Also, I'd like to point out we're making it very easy for GCHQ this evening by broadcasting on 93.2 FM in the Greater Bristol area. Can we please get to the crux of Ukraine, why the problems that are occurring there right now are occurring?
Well, we're coming up to date now.
Not me, because I'm Irish, and I will adamantly assert my neutrality in all conflict situations. However, Britain is a member of NATO, and they're meeting over the bridge right now talking about setting up the potential for World War III.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I'm glad to hear that there's been a ceasefire this afternoon. If we run through events, recent events, what happened is you had both a pro-Western regime and a pro-Russian regime alternating after the Orange Revolution. Now, in a way, that was quite good because it meant that the pro-Western regime didn't push through a shock therapy because they knew that the Eastern Ukraine wouldn't stomach it. And Yanukovych, when he was in power, was prepared to talk about dealing with the EU. The real trick for Ukraine would be to be a buffer state between the East and the West and a zone of mutual cooperation rather than conflict. That's what they really need.
Like Turkey?
To some extent. But, I mean, don't forget that so there are powerful forces in the West who don't want Germany and Russia, for example, to develop an intimate economic relationship. That's going to cause all kinds of problems for the Anglo-American financial elites.
Okay.
So, coming right down to the nitty-gritty, the original shootings in the Maidan Square, I think it was on February the 22nd, something like 80 demonstrators were shot through the head and 20 Berkut police officers. But...
Sounds like kind of accurate shooting, doesn't it?
Very accurate. They were all using the same bullets from the same guns, and they were all shooting from the I think it was the Hotel Ukraina or the Opera. And Umas Piets, who is the Estonian foreign minister, and the Estonians are pretty anti-Russian, but he phoned Catherine Ashton, the British EU commissioner, and said, well, we've just been going around the hospitals, and what the doctors are telling us is that all these people, both protesters and police, have been shot by the same guns with the same calibre ammunition, and they all came from the Hotel Ukraina, which is under the control of Pravi Sector, that is to say, a right-wing paramilitary group. So what happened there, as far as we can see, and the Russians obviously picked up that transcript and pushed it out there, and Umas Piets then eventually had to admit that this is what he'd said. With Catherine Ashton was hilarious. If you hear the transcript, she's going, gosh, golly, really? Gosh, you know, she's supposed to be in charge.
Okay, so here's a mad punt. A right-wing paramilitary organisation in a buffer state in the east of Europe. Where do you think they're getting the money from?
NATO.
Do you think?
Absolutely. Gladio, this is the leaflet I handed out at the demonstration in Saturday in Newport. It says NATO equals Gladio equals terror. Gladio is the code name for a formerly secret NATO structure created originally in the 1940s. It was conceived as a stay-behind network. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if the Soviets invaded, there would be a resistance.
Much like the Mafia were intended in Italy.
Well, indeed, the Mafia in Italy were integrated into Gladio as the Allies advanced up the boot of Italy. If you remember, Lucky Luciano was taken out of prison in New York and told to fix Sicily for the West.
Yeah.
And the reason being, of course, that these people would have voted communist, and that couldn't be allowed.
Oh, it couldn't have that.
No, no. Well, this is the problem. I think democratic socialism is my creed, and this is really what's, you know, there's lots of efforts to frustrate this,
mm-hmm.
from you know, undemocratic socialism, from undemocratic capitalism.
Well, I hate to, you know, pour suds onto your balloon of democratic socialism, but there are two problems with it. It relies on an educated electorate within a stable democracy to make it work. The second point is, and it has been made manifestly clear to us through history, right up to the current day, big business likes to deal with strong men who make things happen in their country.
Well, like the Pinochet option. I mean, it was openly talked about in Eastern Europe. We need a Pinochet option here. You know, so we'll force through the market against the wishes of the population, but they'll thank us for it in the end.
Well, if we look at the fallout from the Arab Spring, which William Hague, amongst others, was saying this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to the Middle East and North Africa, it's somewhat in tatters, especially in light of the Muslim Brotherhood being democratically elected to power in Egypt, subsequent to a coup d'etat.
Well, indeed, and you could argue that Assad has had a presidential election in Syria this year, in which he got some 80-90% of the vote. I would suggest that Assad has got at least as much democratic legitimacy as Sisi in Egypt, because of course they've had a vote, but they banned the Muslim Brotherhood from standing. Mm. Is that a free setup or not? What, in actual fact, what you find is that there are degrees of democracy. So situations are more or less democratic, rather than one or the other. Can I just finish on Ukraine, though?
Because
the plane, if you remember, we were immediately told the headline in the Sun: Putin's missile. Now, in actual fact, the BBC sent their Russian journalists, into the East Ukraine. They interviewed locals who all said the plane was shot down by Kievan fighters. The plane itself had been redirected from its normal route from the Kiev control tower. All of the tapes of the control tower were then seized by the SBU, the Ukrainian secret police, and we've not been able to hear them. The black boxes have been passed via the Russians into the hands of the British, but nobody's mentioned anything that's in them.
Hold on a second. The black boxes from MH17,
yes,
which is the Malaysian airline that was shot down over eastern Ukraine, and there was problems getting the Dutch air crash investigators onto the site because of ongoing civil and military unrest in the area. The bodies were putrefying, and the Russians, or whoever it was, sent down a refrigerated train carriage to stick the 237 corpses into it. These black boxes with the data recorders, the two data recorders from the actual airline, which has audio of what the pilots were talking about at the time, has been through Russian hands and is now residing in British hands after being rescued from a field in the Ukraine. There's a lot of mucky fingerprints on those devices.
There is, but strangely enough, nobody's saying what's in them. And the Western media has gone completely silent. And the Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, the other day, he mentioned what I mentioned about the shootings in the Maidan Square, because they say, well, look, you know, that wasn't us. That was, as you say, far-right group probably working with NATO. There was then the massacre in Odessa, when all these people were burned in the trade union headquarters, again by far-right groups. And that was, I think that was a provocation to make the people in the East scared. And then there's a shooting down of the plane, which the Malaysian press are pretty openly saying it looks like Kiev shot that plane down.
Okay, so what's the upshot of this? Who's behind it? Is it the arms manufacturers? Is it big business? Is it oil companies? Is it politicians?
I think the politicians are fairly low in the food chain. Some know more than others, but mostly they don't know much. The purpose of these atrocities, whether it's a bombing of Moscow in 1999 by the Russians or shooting the plane down by NATO, as it appears to be, is to steer public opinion in certain directions. We do live in a free society to some extent, and people have to be bamboozled. They can't just be told. And that's why we have all of this kind of terrorism and so on going on. A lot of it being the strings are being pulled by the security service. The FSB, Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, was about how he as an FSB agent had been involved in these bombings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got to remember that at the time, Berezovsky, who ultimately fell out with Putin and then became, he then got political asylum in Britain, he was pushing, saying, well, Putin bombed Moscow, because I helped him do it. Mm. Why don't we accuse him of that? And I think that's probably why Berezovsky's dead, because he's just got too big a mouth. The fact of the matter is, he wanted them to use the bombings of Moscow, which he'd been involved in, as a stick to beat Putin with. But of course, Putin then turns around as General Ivashov, former commander of the Russian armed forces, has been quite clear all along, 9/11 was an inside job as well.
Are we on the eve of World War III?
Hopefully not, because the Russians are very have played a very, very canny game. The ceasefire this afternoon, which
they engineered but didn't sign up to, because it doesn't affect them apparently, and they're not directly involved.
All they did was, we will use our good offices to bring Poroshenko and the rebels together.
Who's making all these guns?
There's plenty of guns. What you'll find.
Who's making them? Which country is certifying these as safe to use?
Well, unfortunately, you will find that the world is awash with small arms. It just is.
But who's making it? Somebody has to be manufacturing these things.
They're being manufactured all over the place. The weapons that were used in the shootings in the Maidan, the suggestion is that they were British.
Funny that.
Yes, but a lot of the weaponry being used, that basically the former Soviet Union is awash with weaponry.
Okay.
That's where it's all come from.
Well, Martin, I'm afraid to say we've painted a pretty bleak picture over the last 2 hours. So even our protest vote may not amount to very much in the next general election.
No, but knowledge is power. And I think if this ceasefire can be made to stick in the Ukraine, then I think there is a glimmer of hope there. Between us and chaos is the Russian armed forces, as in the 1940s.
Why don't you just fill me with hope? We're back next week. We're going to have to talk about the Golan Heights. We're going to have to talk about the land grab that's been going on in the Gaza Strip in light of the ceasefire there. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have, I'm delighted to say, Martin Farmer, who is a Labour councillor for South Gloucestershire, coming in to talk to us all about several thousand new homes built around Filton Airfield with no infrastructure for education or recreation. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. A ceasefire deal's been signed to stop the fighting in eastern Ukraine nearly 5 months after the conflict began. The Prime Minister has welcomed the agreement, but also backed plans for more NATO troops to be deployed in eastern Europe, agreed at the summit in South Wales. Speaking in Newport, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko said Moscow had been involved in the discussions.
This ceasefire is based on the agreement which were reached during my phone conversation with the Russian President Putin. The fact that this ceasefire should last long is now our common responsibility.
MPs have voted in favour of a bill which could lead to the so-called bedroom tax being scaled back. Lib Dems joined Labour to support the plans, which would exempt anyone from the spare room subsidy unless a smaller home could be found for them. Former N-Dub singer Dappy has been warned he faces a jail term after being convicted of assault. The